You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
So, as I said at the beginning of the show, we want to talk about history and memory. Everyone is talking about Winnie the documentary, and of course everyone is now engaging the content. You saw the documentary maker yesterday being interviewed on ENCA by Tulus. I thought it was an interesting exchange outside the press conference that was called by Sydney Mufumadi, where he tried to give also his side of the story. And so there are issues specific to the documentary worth talking about, but I thought it might be useful for us to have a broader conversation around history, memory, who gets to tell history, and what are the duties that you have if you are someone writing about history, if you're making films about it, but also what are the duties that we have as readers, as viewers, as listeners, when we approach a particular work. And sometimes it's a work of one, as in this particular case. And some of the debate around this raises many more questions than I think that it settles. And I've got three guests. One who's going to join us a little bit later this hour is Palesa Morudu, who I thought wrote a really beautiful intervention over the last couple of days on some of these issues, in which she asked whether, in relation to Mama Winnie, whether we're trading truth, whether truth is one of the things that sort of is just being trampled on as everyone is accepting a refusal to be held accountable on the part of Mama Winnie. And some tough questions, but a really compelling intervention, I thought. And then, of course, Tandeka Qubule is with me in the studio. Tandeka, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And someone whose commentary I always enjoy, in particular on some of these issues, including yesterday on EMCA, is Angelo Fick, and I'd asked him to be part of this conversation as well. Angelo, thanks so much for coming in.
Good morning, Eusebius.
I want to start with you, Angelo. There are so many competing versions of what happened in 1980, 1970s, etc. How do we begin to approach sometimes incompatible historical narratives?
So I think when we account for history, we often have, we come to those accounts, whether they are the accounts of people who lived through it, or whether they're in history textbooks, or whether we're looking back at what we imagine we remember. It's often a kind of, we don't come at it blank. We come at it with a certain understanding of the present. We have an approach that says, I want to know about this time in the past for these particular reasons. And we find specific people more convincing than others, and not necessarily only on the basis or the substance of what they say, but often also in relation to how we read them politically. So we know this in gendered terms, that often women's versions of histories are often secondary. We take the versions of men more, but that's also because how we value things. So public versions of history are often more valued over private versions of history, and histories of the public are often more interesting to people than histories of privacy. So, for example, we don't pay that much attention to what people were eating in 1976.
Sure.
But we're far more interested in June 1976, what were the public actions that people were performing, even though what they were eating, what clothes they were wearing, are also as interesting to historians for different reasons. And so when we approach history, our judgment is often clouded by our reasons for wanting to understand that history, and also what we know or think we know about that history and what has happened since.
You said something interesting yesterday about the difference in terms of roles between journalists, including documentary makers, and historians. And I thought that was fascinating, because obviously you are not going to let journalists off the hook when we are not rigorous in our journalism, which is what we expect of you as a commentator. But at the same time, you seem to be very clear that certainly for yourself as Angelo, you don't go to a documentary for historical representation. Just tell us a bit more about that.
So any documentary is really an interpretation of the past, and it tells a particular component of that past. No documentary can be complete. So if you look at documentaries about large-scale events like the Second World War, or even our own experiences of late apartheid or even of middle apartheid, they tell a particular component. So they will tell the story of 1976 in Soweto, but they will not tell necessarily the story of rural resistance in KwaZulu-Natal in the same way or in the same documentary. And so in looking at this particular documentary by Patrice Lamshe, I wasn't particularly interested in understanding. I didn't think it was going to tell me the story of Winnie Madikizela Mandela from her birth to her death. That was the context of a particular project that I thought Lamshe wanted to tell, which is the ways in which contemporary understandings in Winnie's late life come from a period of her life that seems to undermine an earlier period in her life. So the period from 1986, 88 onwards shapes how we understood her in 2016. 2016, 2015, and 2017. And we read that against the context of how we had understood her in the 60s and the 50s and what that history was. And it was certainly not a complete picture. And there were several flaws in the documentary, as there would be in any particular documentary, any piece of journalism, any piece of art. Yeah. And so to me, I wasn't going there to understand history. If I wanted to understand Winnie's history, I would read her own words in the two books, 491 Days, Part of My Soul Went With Him. I would look at the historical record and what historians have written about Winnie Madikizela-Mandela, and then compare that with my own understanding and come to some kind of understanding of history. Not that I have knowledge of that full history, but I would have a certain understanding that is mine, that I think this about history and I have the text to back me up.
Tadeka, I asked you to come on the show for two reasons, because you enter this conversation in two different ways, at least. Partly, I love your reflections on the kinds of issues that Angelo have just raised, and I want to draw you in a moment. But also, of course, you have now found yourself, and we don't like as journalists being the news. We like to tell the story, even if we are the rough first draft of history as non-historians. So those subjective choices necessarily that a documentary maker makes, who they go to for interviews, who they exclude, who they believe, they are entitled to do so. They have the right to have that kind of freedom. And the documentary filmmaker yesterday, under the pressure at one stage, said, I've just produced an 84-minute film. You can do with it what you want as journalists in South Africa. Run with it. Tell your own stories. I mean, she felt the weight of everyone now judging her as if this is supposed to be some sort of totalizing account of our history, and it can't be that. But for you, at a very personal level, this is personal. It's not just detached.
And I'm trying to be as detached as possible, because I think that is the public responsibility and the public posture that I should have in the context. There are a lot of very hot heads out there saying a whole lot of unsubstantiated things. And I think that if I can keep my head when everybody around me is losing theirs, I think that I could find a poised way forward. I have a responsibility as a journalist to be factual, to be balanced, and to be as truthful as possible, and to honor history in a meaningful way, to say this is what happened, this is what I reported, this is my interpretation of what I reported, and leave it to society to do the rest.
You don't have a duty to tell the public your sources. It's an important part of our toolkit that we forge certain relationships with sources in order to then tell a certain kind of story to the public. Right. But I've got so many of my listeners, so many of the public saying, like, who were her sources when she was writing about Mama Winnie and about Stompy?
Yes, we have an obligation as journalists to protect our sources and to preserve their privacy. But I made a decision not to name anybody as a source of mine during the story and during the investigation, and also just to name the broad communities of actors from which those sources were drawn. So I have said that it was the churches, and I have said it's the communities around Soweto, and it was the activist communities in 1988. And I have expressly said that none of my sources were official police sources. In fact, the police ran into the newsroom after our return from Soweto upon hearing that we may have discovered something to ask Anton what he discovered. So what was discovered by us. So really, we did not speak to police, and most certainly we would not seek them out as sources. Before, even the communities distrusted the police. We distrusted the police in the context. We're an anti-apartheid newspaper. We didn't want to muddy the waters. We wanted to do our own investigations. And strangely, we took great pride in almost, you know, doing the work that police would normally do, because we distrusted them.
How have you been personally impacted by the last couple of days? I mean, you come out of a couple of years of fighting the good fight at the public broadcaster as part of the SABC 8, and that is, we're all hoping that there's an opportunity. We're not there yet to turn around the organizational culture at the SABC, which Laudy gone doesn't mean that his legacy is gone and the impact of it. And now you find yourself again under relentless public pressure in a week where everyone is suddenly remembering that Winnie Mandela was complex.
Or misremembering.
And then they suddenly you in the invidious position where you have to repudiate a claim that she makes. Is that uncomfortable or not?
First of all, Mrs. Mandela didn't make the claim that I am a Stratcom person or spy. She did not make that claim. That claim is made in a press release issued by the EFF. Now, personally, I just feel bullied sometimes by people who were 7 years old in 1988, and there's a lot of cyberbullying. And because I'm adult, I need to take a step back and say, why is this happening? And to my analysis and to my thinking, the reason this is happening is that...
That musical interlude, where is that? Where is that coming from?
My bag. I'm going to
switch
it off.
Is that the ghost of Stratcom people here? Okay, I'll give you a chance just to find it here. Okay, so it came partly from the EFF, but of course there is also a quote in the docu where you are mentioned by Mbwene, although that comes differently to how the EFF then inscribes it into the public discussion.
No, I'm not quoted in the docu at all. The docu is silent on my issue. This comes from an interview that was done by Huffington Post on the sidelines of the screening of the documentary. The confusion comes in that the documentary maker is filmed seated with Mamuin.
Yes. Mm. Okay.
So let's clear up the confusion. She never said that we are spies. She said we may as well be doing the work of Stratcom because we dared to be critical of the Mandela FC and to investigate its activities.
And how do you feel about that claim? That you may as well be Stratcom? I mean, you can't be indifferent to the Winnie quote, right?
How do you... Basically, Mrs. Mandela and the documentary maker are saying that the football team were Stratcom. Mm. Now, if you expose the activities of the football team... and you work for a newspaper that is seized with exposing Stratcom, how do you then go and take the word of Stratcom as gospel and not the word of the people who actually uncovered Stratcom? Mm. I mean, it's baffling, it's illogical, it's ludicrous.
Fair enough. 19 minutes after 10, we're going to be talking about sources. Which sources does one go to when you are telling a complex history? And then some really important ethical questions I want to raise as well. And of course, you can be part of this conversation. If you have any questions, comments in relation to what Angelo has said or Tandeka, give us a call on 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg. Cape Tonians, you can take part by calling me on 021-446-0567.
CBS Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Angelo, the question of sourcing is quite fascinating when it comes to documenting history, right? Because on the one hand, there obviously is there's a inevitable sense in which the totality of my own academic training, life experiences will determine which sources I go to, which I don't. And then more mundane things like time, money, place that I can travel to may also determine which archives do I trawl through. But this particular documentary, when it first landed, everyone went, wow, it's brilliant. 48 hours later, everyone goes, especially after listening to the filmmaker, well, she's a bit dodge. Why is she saying she couldn't have spoken to Sydney, to Tony, but she had enough time to find other people? How do you see the credibility of it vis-a-vis who was excluded and who was included in the voicing?
So again, I think this has to do with people's expectations of a text. So if you approach this documentary going, it's going to tell me the final truth of the life and times of Winnie Madikizela Mandela, you would be very disappointed because you're going to have that first moment of euphoria and then you're going to go, but where are these versions? Which is precisely what many of the critics are pointing out. But that's not actually a valid criticism, because any text is open to that, because you will have the existing corpus of material on Winnie Madikizela Mandela that excluded her version, her voice. This is set out, this documentary, in my reading of it and in Pascal Lamshe's description of it, to tell Winnie's side of the story, or a side that is sympathetic to Winnie Madikizela Mandela. And in that sense, one must still read it critically rather than, you know, as this kind of objective account that many people want from it. But in going back to the sources, I think there's this idea that you can go back in history, find the material, and somehow it will speak truth to the moment that we're in, as if those sources at the time are not themselves implicated in the political dynamics of that time. So if we look at an ANC statement from, or the MDM, UDF statement, let's be start there, the UDF Mass Democratic Movement statement of 1989, the assumption that that is simply a version that says, oh, we're going to step away from Winnie Madikizela Mandela, without the context understanding of paranoid late apartheid South Africa, the states of emergency, the infiltration of liberation movements by apartheid spies, the destabilizations of townships, that historical context, then you can think that these people simply stepped away from her out of some kind of willful, anxious misogyny. Which is not to deny that misogyny shapes apartheid as well as anti-apartheid activity at the time. Because again, this looking for heroes and villains reduces history to kind of a two-dimensional black and white issue, which it isn't. Yeah. It's textured, it's complicated, it's messy, and what we do as journalists, historians, documentary filmmakers are trying to wrestle order from that chaos in order to begin to understand it. And if we make a documentary about Winnie Madikizela Mandela 10 years from now, new information will have surfaced, our relationship to the past will have shifted. And I think in the wake of the last 10 years of South Africa's history and political economy, it's perhaps understandable that people want easy, nice solutions to the world, and an understanding that says there were some good guys and some bad guys, and these were the good people and these were the bad people. As if that we don't all live very, very complicated, emotionally messy, politically contradictory lives. Yeah. You might be pro animal rights, but be eating beef. You might be somebody who is at the forefront of the struggle for human rights, but part of doing that struggle will require of you to violate the rights of other people.
Absolutely.
And that's not just Winnie Madikizela Mandela, that's all sorts of people in the 1980s.
Yeah. Well, that particular statement that Angela's referring to was issued by the ANC over Radio Freedom, 21st of February 1989. I've just pulled up the text here that I also got last night. Karima on her show read out the whole text. And you wanted to also reflect on it as well, Tandeka. Mm.
Well, I think that the spirit of the time is reflected in that statement. I don't have it in front of me, but the concern for communities, the concern for Mrs. Mandela herself, the concern for the image and the perception of the struggle, the attempt to cleave to the values of dignity, humanity, and concern for all is really, it flows through that statement.
And let me read a couple of paragraphs. Right. It might be useful for those who missed it. Recently, there has been serious developments pertaining to the activities of the group known as the Mandela Football Club, which have raised great concern within the mass democratic movement and the struggling people as a whole. The ANC shares the concern of the people and has all the time tried to intervene to find an amicable solution to the problem. In the light of reports about its activities in the recent past, our organization, complementing the initiatives of leading personalities of the mass democratic movement, tried to use its influence to bring about the disbanding of the group. Unfortunately, our counsel was not heeded by Comrade Winnie Mandela. The situation has been further complicated by the fact that she did not belong to any structures and therefore did not benefit from the discipline, counseling, and collectivity of the mass democratic movement. Under these circumstances, she was left open and vulnerable to committing mistakes which the enemy exploited. One such incident relates to the Mandela Football Club, and then it goes on. And then the second half of the statement basically says, nevertheless, she has, of course, also come under, as Angelo is saying, in terms of the complexity, Tandeka, incredible sacrifices she's made, and she's been harassed. But the statement clearly both is a tribute to what she was enduring, while being very clear on what the movement is also thinking about some of the messy morality of the behavior of the football club.
The movement's dilemmas and anguishes were our dilemmas and anguishes as an anti-apartheid newspaper at the time.
Absolutely. Okay, we've got a caller on the line. Just put on your headphones for me and let's hear what he has to say. We're going to go to Polokwane Rams, good morning and welcome to the show. Hello, Rams. Okay, we've seem to have lost Rams. Okay, we'll come back to that call in a second. Victor tweets or SMSs the following question. This one is specifically for Tandeka. Do you understand, Tandeka, that Mama Winnie never accused you of being an agent journo for Stratcom, but rather that you and Anton Harbour wrote negative stories about her? But I mean, you've answered
yes,
this question,
I've
right?
Yes, I've said exactly that. Yes, that is true.
Yeah.
She never accused me of being an enemy agent.
Absolutely. Okay, give us a call. We're going to just take a call. We're going to just take news headlines in a second. And then on the other side of news headlines, I want to ask some questions in relation to how we make ethical ethical judgments about historical figures. And it's easy to do so with the benefit of hindsight, but how do we bring the complexity of the context within which some of their choices were made to bear on our judgments about them once there's been a passage of time? 011-883-0702 is where you can have your say, and of course, if you're in Cape Town, on 021-446-0566.
Yes. Devious McKaiser on your number one news and talk station.
27 minutes before 10, we're having a discussion about history and memory, and I am joined here in the studio by Angelo Fick and Tandeka Qubule. Let's go back to the lines. Ngaba, good morning.
Good morning, Keith. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, my comment is that I'm not very convinced about the comment of Tandeka. Listen, when she reported these stories at that time, she put the version that, you know, the Winnie Mandela and her court, the clubs, whatever, were doing the wrong things. But she never put the work of the agencies of the apartheid that planted all the wrong stories and perpetuating wrong impression about them and saying, listen, the two sides part of the story, the apartheid are doing this, and this is their version, the truth about them, and this is the way we are doing this and help people, and this is their version. She reported one side of the story, and now she's trying to defend herself. She must put the truth of what happened then, and let people judge what she did and not defend herself about what she did. She might be knowingly or unknowingly colluded and did the work that the apartheid government was doing at the time.
But Ngaba, on what basis are you saying that? I mean, you're entitled to an opinion, but facts still matter.
Listen, read her stories that she wrote that time. Her stories was a version that Winnie was wrong, the club was wrong. She had the same story, also put the version that they ever thought what they were doing, despite that the work that they were doing and planting and perpetuating that and demonizing Winnie Mandela at the same
time.
Can I ask Ngaba, did you see our headline story, our lead story called Dirty Tricks Around Winnie Mandela story, where we exposed what Stratcom was doing to her? It was a front page story. Did you read that? Ngaba, did you read our front page exposés of Stratcom? Because us, no, give me a chance. Us and the Freya Vetblad were the people who actually exposed Stratcom. Did you read those stories of ours?
Did you, Ngaba?
Listen.
Hold on, before we listen, Ngaba, we can have multiple conversations on my show. Let's take it step by step. Park the listen, and let's just get with the first bit. Did you read the stories that she just asked you?
No, I didn't read them.
Okay, no, that's very helpful.
My thing is this, the story that she wrote, that the Mandela Club and the Winnie, what they were doing, and she's saying she was just exposing the things, the wrong things that they were doing. I'm saying to the same article, did she write the other version that what the apartheid spies were doing at the same time, the same story, at the same moment? No, she never did.
You know what's interesting about, for me, Angelo, about Ngaba's refusal to examine his initial view, which he's entitled to, but in light of an interesting factual question from Tandeka, is that it speaks exactly to what you were talking about earlier, how there are psychological, personal, and other issues that we bring to our reading of a text.
And also our desire to have the version of history that we believe to be true. And that's, I understand the difficulty that Ngaba has. with wanting to hear from somebody that he thinks wrote in a particular way, yes. whether she wrote at the moment that she wrote about eggs, whether she also wrote about apples.
What I call the whataboutry in South African discourse.
And it's not just a South African problem. We currently see this as a global phenomenon where people don't really want to give credit to how newspapers worked in the past, how social media works in the present. And there's all sorts of ways in which the immediacy of today wasn't available to us
yes.
30 years ago. So 30 years ago, to construct a newspaper article, to print that newspaper article, to get that newspaper article printed in a country with censorship laws and interventions, was not as simplistic as we have today, this idea that all information is available at all times to anybody who wants to access it. And secondly, I think it's very important that if we're going to judge the past, we should be familiar with the texts of the past. So if you're going to say the Mail and Guardian or the Weekly Mail, let's be specific about what it was called, in 1987 or 1989 or 1991, did X, Y, or Z, what is it that we base that on? Is it based on one article that we remember reading, or is it based on the coverage that the newspaper gave between a date and another date? And what is it that we say that coverage was influenced by? So I think our questions are not necessarily unfair, but they may be historically naive. They may be tainted by our remembering of the time before through the period.
I'm going to bring you in a second, Tandeka. I just want just quick one, Angelo. Presumably what that means is that in addition to what Tandeka said earlier around the duties of journalists to tell the truth, to be evidence sensitive, we struggle sometimes to also talk about the burdens that readers must take on board as responsible readers. So it's okay for you to ask certain questions, but if you become aware of the fact that you have a partial view of what Angelo's journalism was over a period of time, then you must also have a certain amount of sort of epistemic humility about how definitive you can be about what the content of their work over time was.
That's the one component, which is that if we read, it's this habit that we have been taught for a very long time to read only what we already agree with. And that's not particularly useful.
Sure.
But also that if we agree with something, that we can't take a critical stance on it. And that's the second component. And I do want to hand over to Tandeka because I think she has some very urgent points that she wants to make. But my third and last point in this issue is that when we look back, we shouldn't look back for simply going, this journalism article caused that event. I don't think media works in that way. We have to ask ourselves, this journalism article had a certain view of the world, and that view of the world is reiterated, echoed by, or contradicted by education, family, political party, all sorts of other systems in the world that are not, so the media is not solely responsible for how we understand the world. I, for example, lived in a totalitarian society from that time that we are talking about. And in my family, we never believed the newspapers simply for the stories they told us. We took the newspaper story, compared it to what we understood from our political party affiliations, plural, linked that to what we understood from the history textbooks and from our interactions with people on a daily basis. And everybody does this every day to Absolutely. This day across South Africa.
Absolutely. Tandeka.
I wanted to take Ngqaba back to 1988. Quoting the ANC was a subversive thing, and we did it at the Weekly Mail. We phoned on that story, Tom Sabina, and we quoted that part of the ANC statement that says that the ANC believes that there are agent provocateurs sent into the football team to destroy the reputation of Mrs. Mandela and the movement and Mr. Mandela.
Absolutely. Rams, I think we have you back now.
Oh, good morning, Eusebius. How are you?
Extremely well. Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Fine. Thank you very much. Well, this is such an interesting and very complex and convoluted discussion you are having with really very high-brained people like Angelo Fick and Tandeka Kubule. And one is feels like I'm really out of my depth. But what I want to ask about is, are documentaries about newsworthiness or writing history and the whole issue about credibility and validity? The question is really to say that, is this not more complex than we are really admitting? Because we are dealing here with what is a text, something that is written down that can be read by really people who are educated, who are sophisticated, especially in their use of English and so on and so forth. And when we say that people should read our responsibility as readers to read critically, that we should be responsible. Are we not saying that we are using values and standards that are not really very familiar to a large majority of our people? And one would not want to, you know, patronize a person like Mr. Ngaba, who asked that question and does not want to really admit that he did not read something.
But let me engage on that very quickly, Rams, because we're moving on with time. Listen, let me just cut to the chase here.
I think
that the danger is also to patronize Mr. Ngaba by having low expectations of how much he can read. If he's capable of reading one article from the Weekly Mail, then he's capable of reading a second article as well. So I think it cuts both ways. You can be highfalutin, but you can also think that people who are not fluent in English or come from a particular geographical background or schooling background should not be expected to read widely. Why can't they do that, Rams?
No, I'm not saying that they are not expected to read widely, but I think it's a question of the degree to which one understands what is text and what one understands as history, according to one's own background.
Okay, no, fair enough. Angela, you wanted to intervene there?
I think there's also a myth that formal education, and this is to take on what this caller has just said and build on it, so I'm not contradicting what he's saying, but there's this understanding that formal education is required for a critical approach to the world, and that's actually not true, because what formal education often does is it educates you into the mainstream, dominant understanding of the society you live in. Let's not forget that apartheid South Africa produced an entire group of people who were very formula educated inside the South African education system, but had absolutely no critical view of the human rights violations and the crime against humanity perpetrated in their name and to their benefit. And similarly, in contemporary South Africa, formal education often puts people inside the capitalist understanding of the world, the middle class supremacy understanding of the world. And it is poor people who remind us almost on a daily basis by their protests, by their refusal to go by the rule books that we have established for our benefit as middle class people and say, this is not how the world works for me. Mm. And it's that critical consciousness that I think ordinary people constantly and consistently practice in their everyday lives, and that we in the middle classes have the mistake of thinking there's this uneducated mass of stupid people out there who simply behave according to some kind of system. Yeah. That isn't the case. Every day, ordinary people buck the system, interrogate it, refuse to play by its rules because of their ability to read the system critically and knowing that it doesn't benefit them.
I want to change the conversation slightly, and then we're going to take a break. You know, one of the other things that fascinated me coming out of the last couple of days' national conversation is some of the ethical questions, how we judge characters in history. If we take Mama Winnie, for example, besides the false dichotomy, hero versus villain, there's also, I think we struggle because we don't have necessarily the ethical tools with which to make sense of the complex choices that historical figures make. How do we approach that? Because I think part of what's going on here, as I read it, at any rate, Tandeka, in the subtext of the national conversation, is that we really struggle to know how to judge people in context. And one of the things Angelo had said to my producer yesterday is that it's interesting how these things also change over time. If you look at the way in which narratives about the Cold War played out in the 1950s, a decade later, and then in the 1980s, you can have very different perspective just through the passage of time. And I think the moral judgment issue is one that we struggle with.
All judgments are moral judgments, I think. And I think that they are all morals and values are social constructs, and they should be seen in the context of the social, political, and class landscape of South Africa. And I think this is why our conversations in this country are so difficult. We come from different spaces, and we've all experienced a trauma in our different ways. And there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of anger in our discussions, and we straddle the abyss in terms of finding a way to reach out to each other across the big gaps that divide us.
Absolutely.
And then from where we stand, we make various moral judgments. We lob stones at each other from where we stand. And I'm at a loss at this moment as to how we can bridge the chasms.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Angela, I want you to enter this conversation that Tandek and I just started, because I don't know where you fit on this particular one. I mean, I suppose partly my obsession with moral questions come from studying moral philosophy. And sometimes we don't use the moral language, but we are judging people. How do we see our, how do we enter this kind of discourse, particularly when a word like moral, some people prefer the word ethics, is a word that conjures up all sorts of religiosity and all sorts of things?
So I think it's important for us to realize that, you know, we do make judgments all the time. But one of the things that we could do to make better judgments about people, situations, the past, the present, is not to take the contemporary moment in which we make the judgment and assume that history has always been like this. Mm. So when people look at contemporary South African media, for example, and they look at newspapers and television channels and radio channels, they imagine possibly that it was exactly the same 30 years ago. And they forget that that was a country of censorship, of police brutality, of intimidation, and banning. Right. Now, when you call for things to be banned or for people to withdraw things from circulation, you're actually calling on that country that we thought we'd left behind. Similarly, you can't just look back in history and go, why did these people not do the following things? Without recognizing that that shouldn't be a moral question. That is a question of interest to say, why did the people who had slaves not just let these slaves go? Which is, you know, a kind of, clearly, we think of black people as fully human beings. But instead of just denigrating people who didn't think so, it might be much more useful to try and understand why those people thought that the black people doing the labor for free under horrible circumstances didn't think of them as fully human beings. And similarly, when we look back at 1989, don't imagine that 1989 looks like 2018. 1989 had its own dynamics, and it is important to try and understand those dynamics to interpret the texts of that period in order to make a judgment, which is not to say that you forgive or somehow explain away the things that happened at the time, but you understand why people will have made the choices that they've made. So if you want to understand why Murphy Morobe makes the statement that he does, it's useful to understand the context in which that it happens. If you want to understand why a newspaper would publish the things that it does and why the journalists that work at that newspaper get treated the way they do, it might be useful to juxtapose that with what other newspapers are publishing at the time and what the SABC was doing at the time. If you want to say the Mail and Guardian does the following things, which period are you talking about? Was it even called the Mail and Guardian in 1988? Did it have Editor X? Who are the journalists who work there now? And it's that kind of ability to understand the historical context within which something happens that allows you to make a critical judgment that isn't just a denigration or denunciation, because that's easy.
Sure. But what I really enjoyed about Palesa's article in I think it was in Business Day, I read it online, so I'm not sure where it landed first, was that she raised, nevertheless, while doing what Angelo is suggesting, which I think is correct, understanding and explaining fully the operating motives behind the choices that we make, and we are complicated human beings. Mama, when it's complicated, you can't just take one slogan and say, this is irresponsible, this is a call towards violence, when there's a context in which a particular quote lands. But we still judge each other, and we still want to be able to judge each other, right? And I thought Palesa was saying, while there is complexity to some of the choices made by Mama Winnie, that nevertheless, Mama Winnie, in Palesa's analysis as I read her, was someone who was trying to evade accountability. Would you agree with that? Or how do you see it?
In the situation, well, if I were to apply situational ethics to that situation, I would say that Mama Winnie faced the most difficult set of circumstances. She was an internal ANC leader at a time when internal ANC leaders were being killed. Griffiths Mxenge had been killed. I think his wife, also numerous ANC internal figures faced daily threats to their lives, and she did too. And regardless, she went out there to fight the fight of liberation. And as it was said at the Truth Commission, so many things in the heat of battle, so many decisions are so difficult to scrutinize in peace times.
Madeleine Fullard from the Missing Persons Task Team called into my open line the other day, Angelo, after hearing my comment about the exchange between Mama Winnie and Tutu, just a little bit, without other bits being in it, in the Winnie, the documentary. And I made a comment essentially, saying that if you ask someone to ask for forgiveness and you are imbued with a moral authority like the arch is, then you are effectively pronouncing guilt on that person, because forgiveness, compared to, say, a concept like regret, implies that I did something wrong. And Madeleine then said, listen, there was bigger context to this. She was being asked to account and to ask for forgiveness, not just in relation to Stompie, but many other people. And she listed it. And of course, Madeleine is brilliant in her work, and she did that. But there was an interesting sort of awkwardness in our exchange towards the end of that little interaction, where I asked her directly, are you implying that Mama Winnie has got legal or at the very least moral culpability? And that for me is a question that we run away from when we just give explanations of her choices. But surely we must be prepared to tackle that without necessarily not being prepared to be complex about it, because we end up saying that we don't want to answer that question. We just want to give explanations for her choices. Mm-hmm. But then we impute guilt to her by association, like saying, please ask for forgiveness, or saying, but things happened under your watch. We start using elusive language that imply guilt. So why don't we just have the conversation bluntly?
And I think here the problem is that there is this understanding that individual actors are responsible for history. Mm. And so if those individual actors perform badly, then they must be judged and they must either ask for forgiveness or they must pay the price, which is to ignore the systemic creation of history. Mm. So we chose in this country, collectively as well as at the level of political planning, not to pursue all sorts of actions that brought us to the brink of disaster and that engendered the society we lived in, that totalitarian, white supremacist, racist state called apartheid. So all sorts of people got away with it. Mm. I often think of colonialism as the first lottery, apartheid as the second lottery, and for the beneficiaries of those two systems, post-apartheid as a third lottery, because we didn't pursue perpetrators to the extent that we could have. Precisely because to have pursued the perpetrators of the apartheid crime, we would have had to, even-handedly, pursue the perpetrators of crimes against anti-apartheid activists from inside the anti-apartheid stable. Now, that's a decision that was made, a compromise of one of many compromises. So to me, it's not about whether or not Winnie Madikizela-Mandela has individual culpability. It is Winnie Madikizela-Mandela alongside a whole group of other people whose names are never brought up when we talk about this. And that would include Oliver Tambo, Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Joe Slovo, all of these people who are part of that, and not just in the ANC, but in POKO, in AZAPO's wing, in the PAC, questions have to be asked about, are people going to have to be held responsible? And now there was a PAC prisoner who was a prisoner of conscience and a political prisoner into late post-apartheid South Africa, mm-hmm. who was released as late as 2014, who indicated that he did this crime in relation to a human rights agenda and therefore ought to have the same kind of amnesty as other people. But he is being asked to hold individual culpability and responsibility when a class of people are not. And that, I think, is one of the things we need to come to terms with, explain to ourselves. So I'm not necessarily interested in pursuing individuals' guilt. If we're not going to go and pursue individual complicity and implication as class members across the divide, because that, I think, is one of the issues we need to come to terms with in post-apartheid South Africa. If we have a former president who then becomes a deputy president, who is implicated through the work of Terry Bell and Zabeza, Dumeza and Zabeza in unfinished business with all sorts of violations that he knew of. How we pursue that, how we understand that, should shape how we pursue everybody and not how we pursue nobody. And we're not the first society to do this.
Yeah.
Post-war Germany had to do the same thing. Post-1990 East Germany had to do the same thing.
Yeah. Final minute goes to you, Tandeka, not to find a silver lining in a necessarily jarring but important conversation. I wonder whether one thing coming out of the last week, and we'll have to see how it plays out in future, is that finally we are willing to have complicated historical public discussion, because very often much of the public discourse is simply about in-the-moment politics.
There's often a gift in every problem, and I think that this conversation, this national conversation, is the gift.
Thank you, Tandeka. Thank you, Angela.
Thank you.